Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 11th edition of Exploring Enterprise, the podcast series from the Enterprise Research Centre. My name's Stephen Roper. I'm Professor of Enterprise at Warwick Business School and Director of the Enterprise Research Centre. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Jill Pay, Chair of the Gender Index, Yvonne Greaves, Director of Women in Business at NatWest Group, and Julie Capsalis, Chair of Coast to Capital Local Enterprise Partnership. Welcome, everybody, to Exploring Enterprise. I suppose today we're going to focus on a really important issue, which is women in enterprise. And I suppose the context for this discussion is the historical underrepresentation of women in many aspects of entrepreneurial activity in the UK and elsewhere. And that runs right from startup to the scale-up firms and high-growth firms that we see. I suppose also there's been long-standing concerns about the accessibility of finance, both debt and equity, of women-owned enterprises. And that's an issue we'll return to a little bit later in the podcast. And I suppose also when we think about where we're sitting in mid-2022, we're also very aware that many women-owned businesses have been hit very hard by the COVID pandemic. And so there's an element of kind of that recovery and resilience that we might want to return to later on. So Jill, let's come to you first. Getting good data on women and business ownership has been something of a challenge for us for many years, I know. But you're chair of this new online tool called the Gender Index, and that's changing the whole world in terms of UK data, at least for women's enterprise. Tell us a bit more about it.
Oh, thank you, Stephen, and I'm delighted to be joining your podcast this morning. Yeah, the Gender Index is a groundbreaking study into UK female entrepreneurship. It's the first and largest of its kind. And the Gender Index holds real-time data on 4.4 million active companies across the UK. So it creates a national benchmark of the level of activity undertaken by these active companies, from large corporations to SMEs to startups that are owned and led by female founders. And the data can be filtered not only by gender, female, male and mixed, but also by area. So by the UK as a whole, by each of the four countries, by region, by LEP and by local authority. It can be analysed by sector, by investment type, by fast growth and the age of company, or any combination of any number of those filters. So there's a huge range, a huge complexity of report that can be brought out of it. And I mean, one of the red lines for me, that this is free for everyone to access. There is no subscription. It's absolutely free. And by registering, individuals can go in and create their own bespoke reports, as I've said, with any combination of these filters. They can save them in their account and then return and rerun and update them whenever they wish. So we set out to create an accurate picture of the UK company landscape, and that's what we've done.
So I know this is all online, Jill, and we'll include the link to the Gender Index site in the publicity that we put around the podcast, of course. And it's a really nicely designed website. So I've had a good look at it myself and really had a bit of fun playing with looking at contrasts of levels of women's ownership in different areas and some of the sort of financial detail there. But what was the motivation? Why develop the Gender Index now? And what sort of how can it contribute to us to helping us support the development of women-owned business in the UK?
Well, historically, there's been masses of data on the SME sector, lots of smaller sample individual studies. But unless it was just a snapshot kind of survey or report, there wasn't anything that was disaggregated by gender, that was very complex, comprehensive, and published regularly. And there is that old maxim, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. Well, now we can. And lots of the research has shown that women-led companies are a good bet for investors. Quotes, women-led businesses generate 10% more revenue and deliver double the return on investment for their financial backers. Women-led companies are risk-averse and sustain longer than male-led or mixed-led companies. And, you know, I could go on, but there is huge potential to be tapped by investing in women-led companies and an enormous opportunity for investors. But until now, it wasn't possible to focus on what kind of investment was most successful for women-led companies, which sectors were attracted, what kind of investor. All of this was unknown, and it was sort of finger in the wind or stab in the dark. But now we can accurately look at where the opportunities are for investment, and also look at where the areas are where there is more need for support and development. And we know that investment isn't happening. The stats are quite scary at times. But when the Treasury commissioned the Rose Review in 2018, which was led by Alison Rose, CEO of NatWest, and I'm sure Yvonne will talk more about this later, but there was a prediction in the Rose Review first report that if women started and grew their businesses at the same rate as men, this would add £250 billion to the UA economy. So there is huge potential there now. And now with the data and the reports that we can provide through the Gender Index, it's possible to actually pinpoint what needs to happen by whom and where.
Thanks, Jill. So let's move to you, Yvonne. You work for a bank. You're the lead there on women in enterprise. Tell us a little bit about your role there and what NatWest is doing particularly to support women in business.
So, yeah, thanks, Stephen. It's great to be here. And my role is very varied. I work with a lot of phenomenal organisations across the UK, such as the Gender Index and other partnerships. So it's all around making sure that we're working with fantastic partners in the UK and building that proposition around every single stage of the female entrepreneur's journey, all from even from the schools all the way through startup growth phase and into the exit phase. So lots of propositions. We've got lots of different over 1,000 women in business specialists across the UK. These are all externally trained members of staff who go out and they support female entrepreneurs on their business journey. We have mentoring programs, we have we have accelerator programs, we have business builder. So we've got lots of content, everything from digital all the way to face-to-face now that we can get back into this face-to-face space. And it's all around that access to finance, business growth, mentoring and networking. They're the key pillars and they really feed into the Rose Review for female entrepreneurship. So it's a great role.
So what are the challenges that the bank faces in trying to lend to female entrepreneurs? Do they present to the bank differently, or is it more about the type of businesses that they're operating? What are the particular issues that you see in terms of that sort of lending proposition? Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of little challenges at every stage that we hear from female entrepreneurs, we hear from financial institutions as well. So I would say that there's a huge amount of burning ambition out there for female entrepreneurs, huge amount of opportunity. And we saw in COVID particularly that we saw a huge uplift in lending, yes, across the whole of the economy, but we also saw a significant increase and females coming to us for lending. And we think part of the reasons behind that is we made it easier. It was all done online. It was digital. We had to do it online, but it was digital. That we asked for less information. It was quicker. It was slicker. And we saw a huge amount of females that had not traditionally borrowed from us actually borrowing now. There is an element of sectors that do come into it. There's an element that, like, women traditionally are more, we see more females in healthcare, leisure, retail sectors. We see less in manufacturing, real estate, finance, where you tend to have more borrowing into those types of businesses just by the nature of that type of business structure. However, I would say that, you know, like, I do see a lot of females approaching me, and they've maybe not had a great experience the first time they've come to a financial institution, and that puts them off the next time. So that's why we're trying to break down those barriers with our women and business specialists, you know, like, to come approach us. We're also seeing that women are asking for significantly less than men. We see traditional borrowing that will come out in the Investing in Women Code, typically 28,000 for females, 33,000 for men. So it's about that asking for more as well is critical. And sometimes we can oversensitize our numbers. We see that traditionally for females over male-led businesses.
I was going to ask you a little bit more about the Investing in Women Code, because I think that's been a sort of finance industry response, hasn't it, to sort of some of the general challenges about underrepresentation of women in equity and in debt finance. Yes. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So the Investing Women Code has been has really been quite groundbreaking, because we're working with 153 organisations that have signed up to the Investing in Code. all from financial service institutions to angel community to venture capital companies. And we see within this that banks and financial service institutions, we're having to report data into BEIS. We're having to report data that then gets fed into a report, along with best practice case studies. Some interesting stats that came out, I'm a banker, I like stats, but an interesting stat that came out of that was that in the angel community, women are asking for 60% less than male-led businesses. So if we can just understand that there's lots of different challenges within that, then we can actually start to give that support. It's not without its challenges with regards to accessing that data, but the first report came out last year, and what we're really keen to see is the next report that's due to come out at the end of June this year to see, has it changed? Are we starting to see any change with the Investing in Women Code? But I think one of the keys is have a look at it, have a look at some of the numbers. We saw that with the banks, typically women are being accepted for lending around 92%, males 91%. So there's something in there. So we're seeing if women are approaching us, they're typically more likely to get that funding. But we are asking for significantly less. And that's something that we are training our staff to understand as well. And the other organisations and the other banks are definitely looking at that as well in ways that they can support. And we're sharing best practice guidelines.
It's great to hear that there's that kind of landscape, ecosystem-wide effort going on. Let's turn to economic development a little bit more broadly and bring you in, Julie. I know you've been involved in Coastal Capital for a number of years now. Tell us a little bit about your role there, actually, if you like, and some of the issues that you see on the ground in terms of supporting women-owned enterprises and helping them to fulfil their whole potential, if you like.
Yeah, I think the role that the LEPs play is quite unique in terms of bringing together the public, private and third sector to really look at where there's market failure and where we can actually come together through funding, through innovation to address those issues. And actually, I think whether it was by luck or judgment, having Jill, myself and Yvonne on this podcast is an example of where that innovation happened. Because local enterprise partnerships run a program called Growth Hubs, which is about supporting businesses to grow, particularly in their early stages. And we recognised we were just not getting the throughput of women or majority women-owned businesses onto that program. And it goes back to what Jill said about data being key. And I was told it couldn't be done. Couldn't be done. We couldn't get that data in terms of gender disaggregation of data. And it took bringing together NatWest, bringing together Jill and her contacts, MNAI, to actually say this can be done. And then the LEPs being in a position to innovate, to say, let's run a pilot. Let's see if we have this data, what it's going to tell us about the businesses in our area. And suddenly we had that data. And it was probably more shocking than we thought in terms of the limited number of women we were engaged with. But what the data that the gender index is now built on has allowed us to do is to target very specifically to target sectors, areas, postcodes where we were not having that reach, and then to develop initiatives and programs to get into those areas and to make sure that our business support provision was available to all businesses.
Yeah, I just want to add that it's quite right what Julie said about us all coming together, and the whole drive behind the gender index was a collaboration between academia, and we have to acknowledge the work that you led for the university, Steve, and private sector and public sector. The other point I wanted to make is in the report that's on the website that was produced by the work from the universities, the findings are stark. A lot of the findings are stark, but now we know what they are, and they're the springboard for where we need to take the action. So I absolutely endorse what you've said, Julie.
Julie, we've talked a little about finance, but I think that education and training is also very critical here. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about your experience about how that plays into the whole women's enterprise kind of area.
Yeah, I think it's key. And in any conversation about enterprise and business, you know, one of the top two or three priorities that comes up is around skills. And there's both the skills dimension, and then there's also the dimension, how do we ensure people within our schools and colleges and women are seeing enterprise as an option, as a career path. So there's a number of angles, but if I perhaps pick up on some of my reflections, having worked in further education for the last sort of 9 or 10 years. So undoubtedly we see the gender stereotypes within education all the time in terms of the choices that people are making, you know, more men in construction and engineering, more women working in the health and social care sector and some of the service industries. And I think colleges have to play an even more proactive role in addressing that. And that goes back to collaboration, which I think is a real theme. We can't just do that on our own. A lot of these stereotypes are formed at school. We have to work with schools, colleges, universities, and businesses to addressing some of these. And so much of it is about role models. And at Nescot, the college that I work at, we're doing a lot of work about challenging those stereotypes through really robust careers education, role models, work placements, and actually making sure that we are, both the men and women, looking at how we best use their talents as opposed to just following the stereotype or people not questioning where their skills would have the greatest impact. And actually, we've very recently launched a degree program for our students in entrepreneurship and are doing a significant amount of work to grow our female cohort in that area.
I think some great work going on around that sort of entrepreneurship education, you know, across the country and across many colleges and universities. And I'm always amazed at the enthusiasm that it generates in the students in those programs, both male and female, but particularly among women very often. And that's for me is always a great source of inspiration, I think, in many of those kinds of settings. Yvonne, I wanted to bring you in just for a moment around the sort of financial education angle of this, because I guess that's part of what the bank is also trying to do through the Rose Review and perhaps also through the Investing in Women Code. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you're, Julie's absolutely spot on. The financial education really has to come through from the schools, through the colleges, the universities, the whole way through. And I meet a lot of female entrepreneurs that haven't had that opportunity through school or university. And they're coming to me and they're coming to our teams and a bit embarrassed sometimes that they don't understand the numbers. And it's like, don't be embarrassed. That's my job, to understand the numbers. Don't be embarrassed, but we can help support you with that. Your accountant can help support you with that. Going out to having that network around is like collaboration is key, but also building your network so that you can bring in those experts that you know to support you and to help you upskill with the financial education. Yes, a lot of the banks, including ourselves, we have huge programs for building your financial capability. What does cash flow mean? What do accounts look like? But also it's really about making sure that you realize you're not alone. There's many other females and male business owners that don't really understand the numbers as well as they think they should. And I think it's just going out there and asking for help and don't thinking it's just me that doesn't understand what some of the jargon, because let's face it, there's a lot of jargon in this space. And even sometimes I hear a word that I think, what does that mean? And I've been in this space for a long time. So just ask for help, I think, is the key. Reach out to your bank, reach out to your accountant, reach out to your network that you know, and just they're there to help you.
Thanks, Yvonne. Julie, I wanted to ask a quick question. We'll talk about COVID impacts in just a second, but I wondered to get you to reflect just on the support which is currently available for women-owned enterprises in England, perhaps particularly. Is it adequate? Do we need to do more? Are there gaps in that provision that we really still need to think hard about in terms of sort of developing future policy and future support?
I think we absolutely need to do more. I think it's a real priority. Local enterprise partnerships have been playing their role in that through our growth hubs. But our funding has been cut significantly for that area. And I think, you know, as the government focus in terms of looking at devolution, we need to make sure that whatever shape that takes with county deals, or whatever it is, that we do not lose that focus on supporting business startup and growth. And I'm not precious about what organisation leads something. What I'm precious and passionate about is that support is there. And the last thing I'd say on that is it's looking at support at all stages. It's looking at support for women who are thinking of starting a business, that sort of pre startup support, which is invaluable. And there's quite a gap there. Then once the decision has been made, supporting at startup phase, and there's some brilliant work that the banks are doing in that area, and then supporting those businesses, particularly those with growth potential. And it's joining that up. And that has to be a mix of the public, private and third sector working together. But I do think that the government needs to look at more investment in this area, because it will be key to recovery and future growth when we have some pretty tough times ahead. It's an investment that will reap rewards.
Thanks very much, Jill.
Yeah, I was just going to say that through work that we'd done in NatWest before, when we took an economic blueprint roadshow around the country to 6 or 7 different places, there is so much good stuff happening. And, you know, I know what NatWest do and I know what the growth hubs do, but it's all in silos. That is the problem. It's all in silos. And quite a lot of women have responded to the gender index, and I've been talking to them, and they've got companies who do exactly what Yvonne was talking about, preparing people, how to pitch, what are the barriers, but it's all in silos. And what we need is the government to bring that together. And we need a framework of business centres right across the UK, bringing in all the good practice, so they don't have to invest from scratch, because there is so much happening. But we need a framework, so it's absolutely visible where all that support is.
Well, let's hope somebody's listening, Jill, because you know, lots of positive suggestions there, and I think there is some real impetus around this area at the moment with the gender index and other initiatives following on from the Rose Review that we Investing in Women Code, for example, and the council is doing some great work in that area. Let's talk about the challenges of COVID a little bit, and how that's played out for women-owned enterprises. Julie, let's start with you. What have you seen in terms of the kind of the effects of this, has the effect been on the starting point of your sort of pipeline around the startup phase, or has it been more on the kind of growth and development of women-owned businesses?
I'd say it's actually been at every step of the journey. And I was reflecting on some research that the University of Sussex carried out during COVID, where the figures were that 60% of women with a work commitment were the default parent during COVID, during those exceptionally challenging times of homeschooling. And undoubtedly, the impact of that, the tail of that goes long beyond us moving out of lockdowns and homeschooling, and will continue to have a significant impact, whether that is women who decided not to go forward with plans. I know a number of women that we work with who had to put their businesses on hold because it was one too many thing to juggle. But you know, despite some of the great strides that have been made in terms of gender inequalities over the last few years, I do think that the coronavirus pandemic has set back progress for women. And, you know, with rising costs across the board, but particularly childcare, I also have a really significant concern what that will do. And I think that then plays in the balance of opportunity versus necessity entrepreneurship. But undoubtedly, the impact was significant both during those 2 years and will continue to be for a significant period of time.
And Yvonne, how is this playing out in the context of the bank? I mean, I assume that, you know, lending behaviours and aspirations in terms of, you know, investing for growth have probably been rather different over the last year or two than they might have been historically.
No, absolutely. And just to echo what Julie said, like we also produced some reports and we saw that the childcare challenge came back in again, very much that women were typically going back to sort of 6 to 10 extra hours a week on that childcare and that homeschooling. And we also saw a significant challenge around the sectors again, coming back to, like, say, for example, the beauty sector. And it really annoyed me at the time, some of the narrative that was around that was said around the beauty sector, or let's get the women back to the hairdressers. completely undermining a phenomenal sector of our society that brings in a huge amount of income into the economy. So I think there's a huge challenge. We have seen a lot around the type of businesses that females typically had. They probably went into hibernation a little bit more sometimes than male counterparts. And we saw in like 62% of female entrepreneurs were less likely to report recovery post-pandemic. So it's not always just about lending. Lending is a good metric, but it's all around that wraparound service that we offer for entrepreneurs as well. It's around, you know, like making sure that they're plugged into the right networks, about coming onto accelerator programs. It's not just about a lending, although I do appreciate it as a good metric for the economic aspect of it. We've seen a huge uplift. We, you know, like over a billion in borrowing to female entrepreneurs in 2020. We saw for NatWest Group, that's a significant uplift. Okay, COVID impacted. What we're waiting to see is what happens year two, three, four post-recovery. What is it going to be like then? And I think that would be the true metric of this, what's out there. So I don't think we can all rest in our laurels and say we've done enough. There's a lot more to come now, I would say.
There's just a, sort of something to add to that, that the data tells us that in 2021, 20% of the new incorporations were women-led companies, which is a rising trend. But that 20% were in the younger sectors where they were less likely to have those caring responsibilities. So it'll be interesting to look at that cohort and see what happens as they progress through, which we'll be able to do.
And just one additional thing, it'll be interesting to see if we start to see some opening, like, women post 40 entrepreneurship, you know, a significant rise in that aspect as well. There's going to be some fantastic data that we can learn from and insights coming forward now that we have the gender index, we have the investing women code. We didn't have any of that before.
You know, I think this all contributes to a rather different environment going forward, and that should be should all be very positive. We're at a point, I think, in life where in the world where, you know, with the Ukraine crisis and supply chain issues and the recovery from COVID and the increasing costs, that for businesses of all sorts, it's going to be a very challenging period. Maybe let's just think of a couple of quick suggestions each, which policymakers might put in place to try to support businesses as we go forward and try and continue to sort of tackle the gender gap in enterprise. Julie, do you want to? Would you kick off with a couple of your priorities for future policy?
Yeah, and these are things we've touched on. For me, the childcare piece, looking at affordable childcare is key. We know it is a significant barrier that it's talked about a lot, but I don't really see much happening by government to significantly address it. And the second one, the advantage of going first is I can steal other people's points, would be Jill's point, which is around joining up that business support. And actually, what government really could be doing there is being a catalyst to join that up, make the landscape easier for people to access. It's a minefield of stuff out there. And I think that would have a huge impact, people knowing where to go to get quality, impartial advice.
Okay, thanks, Julie, very much. Yvonne, I don't know whether you don't need to restrict yourself to finance. What do you see when you look out into the landscape? What's the priority for you?
I think I would love to see that when we're building these policies and we're building these propositions, like at that sort of macro level, I would love to see that we have a diverse group of decision makers in the room, that we have lots of females in the room, ethnic business owners. We have a real diverse and inclusive group that are actually building those policies, because I think that makes a massive difference. And I would echo really, and yes, you're right, Julie, you did say what I was going to say, but I would definitely echo what Julie said around that childcare aspect as well, because it is when we see a lot of female entrepreneurs deciding they want to set up in business because they just don't know how they're going to juggle that. I did it myself. I was the same, like when my children were babies, small. How do you juggle it? You go and set up a business. So I'd really love to see something around that.
Jill, is there anything left to say?
Well, I would just add to it that I think it needs a public-private sector collaboration to look at all caring responsibilities. Because you get to the stage where, your children have been through university, they've flown, and then you have other end of life caring responsibilities. So I think that whole area needs looking at. Obviously, I support everything that Julie and Yvonne have said. The one thing that I think would make a huge difference, and I don't believe in quotas, but I don't know if you're aware, but in the US, in about 2015, they set a target that 5% of all public body contracts were to be let to women-led companies. And they achieved that in April 2019. Now, I think actually at the moment, our public bodies don't know how many women-led companies they let contracts to. So there's a way to go. But I think if we could get them that it was a requirement for all public bodies to collect that data on the contracts they let, then we could move towards that. And I think that would make a real difference at the highest level.
I think procurement is certainly one of the levers that is possible, and a new one that we haven't used in the UK before, alongside all of the other things. So thank you very much, everyone, for what's been a fascinating conversation this morning, and lots of really hopeful ideas, I think, there. The economic context, I don't think, looks great, but in terms of, you know, supporting women-owned enterprises at all stages of the pipeline, as it were, from pre-startup right through to scale up, I think we're beginning to get an apparatus and a coalition around this, which I hope will be really powerful in years to come. So thanks very much for your participation today, Jill, Yvonne and Julie. The conversation was really thought-provoking. Thanks to everyone for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, there will be other ERC podcasts. And if you want to find out more about ERC's work, visit the ERC website at www.enterpriseresearch.ac.uk. And Jill, what's the website for the Gender Index?
www.thegenderindex.co.uk, all small letters.
And we'll include a link to that in the publicity for the podcast. So keep your eyes open for that. Thanks again, everyone, and thank you for listening.